But what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A U.S. appeals court Tuesday held a hearing on President Donald Trump's January 27 executive order placing a temporary travel ban on people from seven countries entering the U.S. That order put on hold by a lower federal judge. The three-judge panel said it would issue a ruling soon. During more than an hour of oral argument, the Justice Department Special Counsel August Flinchy argued the president has the authority to suspend entry of those considered national security risks.
That's what the president did here. And the president's determination that a 90-day pause was needed for the seven countries at issue here in order to ensure adequate standards, and that's language from the order, for visa screening was plainly constitutional.
But the Solicitor General for Washington State, Noah Purcell, insisted the government failed to provide evidence of irreparable harm if the president's order was blocked.
It has always been the judicial branch's role to say what the law is and to serve as a check on abuses by the executive branch. That judicial role has never been more important in recent memory than it is today.
Both sides expect the case to wind up before the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly defended the ban Tuesday before lawmakers.
The president's recent executive order to temporarily suspend entry for foreign nationals from seven countries, we believe, is lawful and constitutional, and the review ordered by the president is necessary and appropriate.
The order bars travelers from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen from entering the U.S. for 90 days, all refugees for 120 days, Syrians indefinitely. Disgruntled Ivorian troops Tuesday fired weapons into the air and seized control of the southeastern town of Adiake in a further sign of discontent among military personnel. The country suffered a number of mutinies last month focused on payment of bonuses. This is VOA News. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said his family does not own the country that they've ruled for nearly half a century and said he's prepared to step aside if the people choose another leader in elections. Speaking with Belgian journalists Tuesday, Mr. Assad insisted his government has tried to negotiate an end to the nearly six-year conflict.
Actually, since the beginning of the crisis of the war on Syria, we used every possible way. We didn't leave any stone unturned in order to bring people to the negotiating table. But when you talk about the terrorists, when you talk about terrorists, when you talk about Al-Qaeda, when you talk about al-Nusra and ISIS, I don't think anyone in this world would believe that they are ready for dialogue.
Meanwhile, airstrikes targeting the rebel-held northwest Syrian city of Idlib left at least 30 dead, and the UN Special Envoy for Syria warned only one UN-led humanitarian convoy reached besieged areas of the country last month, the worst month for aid deliveries since last March. At least 20 people killed Tuesday in a bomb blast outside the Afghan Supreme Court in Kabul. More than 40 wounded. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Haitian businessman Jovenel Moïse was sworn in Tuesday as the Caribbean nation's president following an oft-delayed presidential election. He promised to carry out a national project of development, the wealthy banana exporter promising to focus on modernizing agriculture. Mr. Moïse declared winner last month in an election process that began in 2015, had to be rerun amid allegations of voter fraud. Colombia's government and the nation's second biggest rebel group began official peace talks Tuesday in a bid to bring more than half a century of violence to an end. The National Liberation Army seeking an agreement similar to one reached last year between Bogota and the larger Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands, left millions displaced, and caused economic hardship. Pop singer Madonna adopted two more children from Malawi Tuesday, bringing to four the number granted to her care by a Malawian court. Malenga Mvula is a Malawian court spokesman.
The court also endorsed that these two little kids need to be under good environment, and Madonna is capable of doing that. And secondly, we are looking at the welfare or the well-being of these little kids.
The 58-year-old Madonna earlier denied seeking to adopt more children when in Malawi, saying she was focused on her charity, Raising Malawi, which provides health and education programs. The U.S. Army says it's prepared to approve the controversial Dakota Access Oil Pipeline despite opposition from Native American tribes. The Standing Rock Sioux, whose reservation is adjacent to the line's route, vows to challenge the decision, arguing it would desecrate sacred sites and cause pollution. Pipeline designed to move oil cheaply to Gulf Coast refineries. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The people of Somalia are voting today in presidential election.
We don't believe that the current parliament of the two houses are not patriotic. We believe that the challenges coming from the corruption, mispractices, intimidation and harassment will be defeated by the current two houses of the parliament.
Ali Mohamed Gedi is a former prime minister of Somalia. Liberia's Elections Commission chair says voter registration for the 2017 election is progressing with some minor problems. Deteriorating conditions in overcrowded Burundian refugee camps. Are Burundian hospitals imprisoning patients for failure to pay bills? And President Donald Trump's travel ban creates confusion at Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp.
My hope is Mr. Trump is changing his mind and the law will be prevail in order to release us from this harsh life.
That's refugee Ahmed Omar Bihi. And South Sudan President Salva Kiir says his national dialogue will start early next month. Those stories, plus our Black History Month facts and contest, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Security has been tightened in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, ahead of today, Wednesday's presidential election. The run-up to the vote has been tumultuous, with repeated delays and allegations of corruption. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The presidential vote has been postponed four times, but Wednesday, parliament is expected to finally gather at the Mogadishu International Airport, chosen for security reasons, and elect the country's next leader. The polls have been messy at best, mired in accusations of widespread vote buying. Seats in parliament allegedly went for thousands of dollars each late last year. VOA's Somali service spoke to former Prime Minister Ali Mohamed Gedi, who expects better during Wednesday vote.
We don't believe that the current parliament of the two houses are not patriotic, are not loyal to their people and their country. We believe that they will overcome, that we believe that the challenges coming from the corruption, mispractices, intimidation and harassment will be defeated by the current two houses of the parliament.
Somalia cannot hold direct nationwide elections due to ongoing insecurity and logistical issues, like the lack of a national census. So parliamentary members were elected by select clan leaders and regional representatives. The presidential candidates debated Monday before parliament. Running for re-election President Hassan Sheikh Mahamud said the next polls will be better. The president says he will build a national system that is democratic and represents Somalis. The system will lead to a formation of political parties, not a system made up of clans, region and groups. I will lead the country to one man, one vote system in the year 2020. But former Mogadishu mayor and presidential candidate Mohamud Tarzan Nur said he did not like what he saw during the debate. He says the people of Somalia are hopeful. They want you to listen to the presidential candidates and elect who is qualified to lead. He says the chamber was almost empty. It is sad, and it seems those who are not here have already made up their mind who they are going to vote for. The incumbent is expected to get stiff competition from his predecessor, Sharif Sheikh Ahmed. With so many candidates, the voting is expected to require multiple rounds Wednesday. Somali media has been abuzz for days with the reports of candidates forming alliances, pledging support if eliminated. Some presidential hopefuls have been accused of bribing lawmakers to vote for them. During the lower house elections, some candidates' names were removed from the list and races had to be rerun after corruption and other electoral offences were detected. The chairman of the Independent Anti-Corruption Committee, Professor Abdi Ismail Samata, said Monday the committee is on alert. He says for a credible result, the process must be transparent. He adds Somalia must reduce corruption and lawmakers need to be transparent in their actions. And if lawmakers observe others receiving and taking bribes, they need to report them to the relevant authorities to take action. But analysts say candidates will also be peddling influence. Power-sharing agreements and cabinet posts will be valuable but gaining cheap as votes are cast. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The chairman of Liberia's National Elections Commission says voter registration for the 2017 general election, which began a week ago, is progressing with some minor problems. Councillor Jerome Kokoya says about 600,000 voters have been registered after just 1 week. This is the first post-Civil War election that the Liberian government will be solely responsible for funding. Kokoya said while the government has shown commitment to funding the process, it has not made available the total amount needed to fund the entire election because of the country's difficult economic crisis. Instead, Kokoya says the electoral calendar is being funded in segments.
The process is going well. Of course, you know, these kind of electoral activities are usually characterized by minor problems here and there. So this one is no exception. We have some technical issue with the cameras that were brought in by our partners. They are not functioning most of the areas they were deployed. And that is causing some little frustration on the part of some of the citizens that turn out to register. But the good news is that we are working along with the partner, that's the UNDP, to address the situation. Next to that, of course, had to do with, you know, we use public facilities like school buildings, charges, and some private school buildings for registration and polling centers. So there are some contention out there from some of the owners or administrators of these facilities with respect to concerns such as they were not contacted before, or they didn't receive some staffing compensation for the use. But we are working towards that, and that is not a major obstacle at all. Otherwise, we are moving. Right now, I can say that we are well over 600,000 mark now, and I think that is good, given that we just started last Wednesday and with some of these other issues.
Mr. Chairman, during my trip to Liberia last June, I had the opportunity to talk with you the issue of whether your commission has the necessary funding to conduct this very crucial election came up. So how are you doing in terms of finances?
Let me say this first, James. This is a post-conflict country. Financial situation nationally is not that great, but however, we're surviving. And I can say to you that the government has always been there to provide the funding we need. In the midst of all these global financial constraints, I believe that that is a good step, a good effort towards the process.
I asked the question about finances because I was reading an article from Liberia which said that some group were saying, in fact, if your commission does not get the necessary funding, then the election should be postponed. Compared to 2011, in terms of funding for elections, how are you doing in terms of that?
But again, this is the thing. You know, there can be no such thing like postponing elections. You know that cannot happen. So the elections will be held, and we will have a successful, credible, and transparent process. With respect to comparing 2011 to this time, I was not at a commission then, but information that I received showed that there were a lot of donor involvement. At this point, the question as to whether I'm getting all of the money that I need on time, I would say no. But that is not because of any intentional effort by the government not to fund me. I want to just be clear here, because very often people try to take this out of context. I am convinced as chairman of the Election Commission that the government is committed to funding the process. So what we have done is, because of the obvious national situation, financial problem, we are in discussion with the Ministry of Finance where we divide the process into stages, because we don't have the huge amount of money to just deposit it into my account and just move forward. So what we have done is, because the process is important and because the government itself has demonstrated commitment to the process, what we have done is, look, we don't have maybe the $45 million we need now to just put it aside. And so, therefore, what we're going to do is, let's take all the important stages. For example, we're doing voter registration now. All the materials we needed for the voter registration may not be $45 million. But can we take that off now and set it up and address this on your stages? We agree to that.
Mr. Chairman, what about political parties and potential presidential candidates? Are you getting cooperation from political parties?
Yes, sir. And this is why I continue to say that this election will be one of the best. Trust me, James, there are a lot of good things happening. Usually you have the political party disagreeing with everything the commission says in many places, not just Liberia. But we have had this special kind of relationship, I guess, because we have put into place several steps and mechanism that would enhance cooperation. In every situation, of course, you'll find one or two deviants. So there are some people who have been involved in pre-campaign activities, but we're trying to address that.
Mr. Chairman, we are very happy to have you on Daybreak Africa, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, James. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jerome Kokoya is chairman of Liberia's National Elections Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Today is Wednesday, February 8th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Confusion reigns in Kenya over the status of the U.S. travel ban, though a U.S. federal judge put the ban on hold. Somali and Sudanese refugees ready to fly to the United States have been sent back to the Kakuma and Dadaab refugee camps. Other refugees farther along in the U.S. immigration process are worried, but they have not lost hope of the ban being lifted. From Kakuma, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
President Donald Trump's travel ban and its legal challenges have caused much anxiety in the Kenyan refugee camps of Kakuma and Dadaab, where those slated for resettlement in the United States are unsure of their futures. The president has argued that temporary measures are necessary to keep the country safe from terrorism. Refugee organizations respond that refugees already are vigorously vetted. Here in Kakuma, 48-year-old Michael Abukasim Kuku, a refugee from Nuba, Sudan, was scheduled to fly to the Refugee Processing Center in Nairobi on January 30th. From there, he was to join his wife in Des Moines, Iowa. But the ban prevented his departure. He says, "I felt really bad and it really affected me. When I was told the ban was there and we were not supposed to go, then that really gave me a hard time." Kuku received a phone call that he is to report to the International Organization for Migration office on February 17th for his flight to Nairobi. He is hopeful that this time he will be successful. Another Sudanese refugee, 24-year-old Abdulaziz Yasir Yahya from Darfur, also was scheduled to fly to Nairobi on January 30th for processing, and then to his new home in Tucson, Arizona. But he remains here. He says, "I want to go to America because my homeland is still in war, and we are just living with no hope. So when I go to America, I might be able to go to school." Ahmed Omar Bihi has lived in refugee camps since 1992, when he fled warfare in Somalia. He lived in Dadaab until 2013, when he was transferred to Kakuma. Bihi was told to expect his U.S. resettlement before March. Now, though, he hopes for the best.
My hope is Mr. Trump is changing his mind and the law will be prevailing in order to release us from this harsh life.
Somali refugee Kali Abubakar Muhammad says she was scheduled to leave for her new home in St. Louis, Missouri on February 1st. Instead, however, she was sent back to Dadaab.
But we don't know the reason why people are doing this discrimination.
Yvonne Ndege is the UNHCR Kenya spokesperson.
Well, we're following very closely all the developments going on in the U.S., and the situation is obviously fluid and things are changing constantly, but UNHCR Kenya's understanding is that we are okay for the time being to continue resettling refugees in the United States whilst the legal issues in the United States are resolved.
A request for response from the IOM was not immediately returned. A State Department spokesperson said the processing of refugees is ongoing in Nairobi, including for travel to the United States. The ban suspended for 90 days entry into the United States by citizens from seven Muslim-majority countries where terrorist groups are active, including Somalia and Sudan. All refugees needed to wait 120 days, with the exception of Syrians, who would be barred from entry indefinitely. But for these refugees in Kenya, they hope the legalities can be sorted out, and they can soon begin their lives in the United States. Jill Craig, VOA News, Kakuma, Kenya.
The UN Refugee Agency says conditions in camps for Burundian refugees in countries of asylum are deteriorating and that more land is urgently needed to accommodate the growing number of new refugee arrivals. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Tanzania, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo are hosting more than 386,000 Burundian refugees. The UN Refugee Agency expects that number to exceed 500,000 this year as refugees continue to flee political instability and abuse in Burundi. Peace talks between the government and opposition are stalled, though Burundi has largely fallen off the media radar. UNHCR spokesman Leo Dobbs tells VOA the crisis gripping the country remains acute.
There are still reports of forced disappearances, targeted assassinations, and extrajudicial killings of civilians and law enforcement agents. There are also sporadic attacks by unidentified armed people. So the situation is still quite grave, and hundreds of people are still leaving. There's still a flow, hundreds of people a week.
As more Burundians flee into neighboring countries, the UNHCR says the pressure for land there is rising. It says the situation is most serious in Tanzania, which is hosting more than 222,000 people. Dobbs says the UNHCR and its partners are working feverishly with the countries of asylum to find more land to ensure shelter.
With the problem of space, if it's not resolved and we don't get more land, then there's a danger that conditions will deteriorate and aid delivery will be affected.
Besides the urgent need for more land, the UNHCR says existing camp facilities must be upgraded, including construction of more homes, schools, health centers, and better drainage systems to lessen the risk of disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Burundi's government is trying to improve the country's healthcare system. However, some patients are confined in public hospitals for failure to clear their bills. Moses Havyarimana has the story from Bujumbura.
In 2006, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza introduced the free maternal and child health care system. According to the African Development Bank, the hospital delivery rate increased from 22% in 2005 to 41% in 2009, and the infant mortality rate has also increased. Hospitals in Burundi are still facing challenges to cope up with the rising number of patients who don't fall in this category. Prince Regent Hospital is one of the biggest public hospitals in Burundi that accommodates 600 patients. The hospital is known for providing affordable services to Burundians, but some are confined here.
We are not expensive, and we treat first. People came, we treat them, but every month we can find almost 10 people who are not able to pay their bill. And if you do the calculation, you are going to find that after a year we can find more than 200 people who are not able to pay their bill.
Patients who have failed to clear their bills are confined in the hospitals for months. They can only await good-willing people or Ministry of Solidarity to pay their bills. But even sometimes, they abscond. Petronia has spent more than a month in the hospital after failing to clear her bill that is worth $100.
I told them that I didn't have money to pay for the bill because I don't even have a job. That's why I'm pleading for good-willing people to help me.
In 2012, Burundi government initiated a medical assistance card which allows patients to only pay 20% of their prescribed bills. The card costs $2 for the whole family that only includes children below 18 years of age.
Our message is to sensitize people to begin by a health center and to go through the reference system, because those packages are offered by a district hospital.
Children above 5 years of age are not entitled for the free healthcare system in Burundi. Ndayishimiye Claria was confined in the hospital for more than 2 months now. Her bill is approximately $50. Many like Claria, the hospital has become a prison for them. They are missing school and still not expected to leave the hospital unless the bills are cleared. Moses Havyarimana, for Voice of America, Bujumbura.
stand up for your right.
It's time now for Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 8th. On this day, 1986, figure skater Debbie Thomas became the first African-American to win the women's singles of the U.S. National Figure Skating Championship competition. She went on to win a bronze medal in the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary, Canada, before retiring from amateur figure skating. Also on this day, 1978, Leon Spinks defeated world heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali. Ali regained the title on September 15th that same year and went on to become the first person to win the heavyweight boxing title three times. On this day in 1986, Oprah Gail Winfrey became the first African-American woman to host a national television talk show, The Oprah Winfrey Show. It became the highest-rated talk show in history, reaching about 15 million viewers a day in the United States alone. The show ended in May 2011 after 25 years on the air. Winfrey now has her own television network called the Oprah Winfrey Network. On this day in 1894, the United States Congress repealed the Enforcement Act, thereby making it easier for states, especially in the South, to take away black voting rights. Originally passed in 1870, the act had established criminal penalties for interfering with a person's right to vote. But after its repeal, southern states passed a host of measures to block or limit the number of blacks who could vote. On this day in 1925, Marcus Mosiah Garvey, sometimes called the Black Moses, entered federal prison in Atlanta, Georgia, after being convicted of what many blacks felt were trumped-up mail fraud charges. Garvey had built the largest black mass movement in African-American history by emphasizing racial pride, economic empowerment, and the building of a black empire in Africa. Did you know that Gwendolyn Brooks was the first African-American to receive the Pulitzer Prize? She received the award in 1950 for her work in poetry. Born in 1917, Brooks published her first poem when she was only about 13 years old. She later served a year as consultant to the Library of Congress and taught creative writing at several colleges. In African history, on this day in 1994, a cargo plane crashed in the Democratic Republic of Congo, killing at least several hundred people and wounding more than 500. And in African history, on this day in 1952, Elizabeth of England, while walking on the grounds of the Tree Tops Hotel in Kenya, is informed by husband Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, that she has become the Queen of England. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 8th. Congratulations to Tam John Elvis Ali of the University of Deschamps in Cameroon, Charles Wompia of Kumasi, Ghana, and Jardine Siwale of Kitwe in Zambia. You are the winners of our February 7th question: which African-American tennis player was the first to win at Wimbledon? The answer, Arthur Robert Ashe. Now, here is our question for today, February 8th. Who is considered the first female African-American millionaire? Once again, who is considered the first female African-American millionaire? Send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. Don't know what life is really worth. It's a cord that Peter is cold. After story had never been told. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Security has been tightened in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, ahead of today, Wednesday's presidential election. The run-up to the vote has been tumultuous with repeated delays and allegations of corruption. And the chairman of Liberia's National Elections Commission says voter registration for the 2017 general election, which began a week ago, is progressing with some minor problems. That's it for this Wednesday, February 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everybody a very good day.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 16:30 to 1700 UTC, We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.